From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Jane Clayson. It's Here and Now. This morning, President Biden said, "Our economy is on the move and we have COVID-19 on the run." That was after the Labor Department reported that employers created 850,000 jobs last month, more than expected.
And yesterday, the president and the first lady visited with families who've lost loved ones in the Florida condo building collapse.
Jill and I wanted them to know that we're with them and the country's with them. Our message today is that we're here for you as one nation, as one nation.
Our Friday Politics Roundtable is here now. Ayesha Roscoe is NPR White House correspondent. Hi, Ayesha.
Hello.
And Olivia Nuzzi is New York Magazine Washington correspondent. Olivia, welcome to you.
Thank you for having me.
And Olivia, start with you. Even Florida's Republican governor, Ron DeSantis, praised Biden yesterday for his visit. How did the president do?
Well, I think that this is, unfortunately, one of the things that Biden is best at. He is terrific under the pressure of a tragedy. He's very good at talking about heartbreak and horror because of his personal experience that everyone is familiar with by now. He has dealt with a lot of personal tragedy in his family dating back to the 1970s when he was first elected to the Senate. And he really is skilled. You see it when you're up close with him, when he's talking to voters and they tell him a story, something heartbreaking that's happened in their family or in their life. He really does connect with people. And I think that he, especially in contrast with the previous president, who was not exactly known for empathy, it's pretty stark just how skilled Biden is at being really the comforter in chief.
Well, Ayesha, what about the rest of the president's week? There was this good jobs report today, but employers are still having trouble hiring. And then Reuters had a poll out this week that showed the president's actually losing some support among Democrats, particularly those under the age of 40. Is this a precarious time for the president?
It's a time when I think the honeymoon is wearing off a little bit. Some of those warm feelings from younger Democrats may be eroding just a bit, just because this is the time where the rubber is starting to meet the road. This is the time when people want President Biden to deliver, the people that voted for him and supported him, but that is a very complicated issue. The economy is doing better, but you still have millions of people out of work, and the economy still has not recovered from where it was to where it was before the pandemic. So you still have a lot of people struggling, and you have a lot of Democrats who want Biden to be more forceful. They are very skeptical about this push for bipartisanship and trying to do this two-track thing on infrastructure and jobs in Congress, where he's trying to work with Republicans on one smaller part and then do a bigger part. They're skeptical of that, and they want more action and less of this reaching across the aisle. Of course, that is what Biden campaigned on, though, and that is his style. So I think that's where the tension is coming in.
Yesterday's ruling by the U.S. Supreme Court dealt a blow to the Voting Rights Act. Olivia, what are the political implications ahead on this one?
Well, the ruling itself, if you read it, it's phrased in a pretty subdued way. But the experts are saying that the implications are pretty dramatic for what this means going forward, if for people who want to challenge the voting laws in places put in place by Republicans over the last couple of years to restrict voting access. That this ruling, which was along ideological lines, that this ruling is going to make it much, much more difficult for those laws to be challenged. And I think that's something that a lot of progressives have been focused on, especially over the last year, especially leaving behind the most recent general election. And I think that reading the coverage today, I saw quite a lot of regret from Democrats about how they handled this case, which I thought was interesting. And it seems like they're bracing for it to be a much, much more difficult fight going forward, challenging these laws.
Well, Democrats in Congress are trying to pass new voting legislation to expand voting rights now, but it's stalled in the Senate. Aisha, has the Supreme Court ruling changed at all the fate of that bill, do you think?
There is a thought that it will increase pressure because the only way that the administration can make a real significant change or enact the protections that civil rights groups want is through Congress, is through legislation. And I talked with civil rights groups this week, including the NAACP, and what they say is that at this point, the status quo is unacceptable. They want something to happen with Congress, and anything less than that is not going that it cannot be spun into a win. They want something to go through Congress, and they do not want the filibuster, that rule that requires 60 votes in the Senate, to stand in the way. So eventually, at some point, if bipartisanship doesn't work, they want Biden to really press lawmakers to make changes to the filibuster to ensure that something can get through Congress. Of course, the problem is that there is not enough support right now for Democrats to make changes to the filibuster.
You know, I think as we're talking about Democrats, some Democrats, according to the most recent polls, kind of losing a bit of faith in Biden or beginning to tire of all of these fights going on, I think part of the problem is that there's only so much that you can accomplish with executive orders or outside of legislation. And it's beginning, I think, to dawn on people the reality that if you really do want to make any changes that will survive in whatever the next administration is, if there's a change of party at the next administration, it really has to be through legislation. And I think that the lack of patience that we're seeing from some Democrats about how committed President Biden is to trying to work across the aisle, as Aisha said, I think that is really coming to a head on a number of these issues all at the same time. I'm curious to see, because right now, if you look at the approval ratings, President Biden's not that different from many recent presidents. He's quite a lot more popular than Donald Trump was at this time. But it's pretty standard where he is now. But I am curious to see if his kind of magical thinking in terms of getting Republicans to work with him will start to really wear thin on people over the next 6 months or so.
I want to touch on another big story in Washington this week. Only two House Republicans, Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger, joined Democrats to vote for a select committee that will investigate the January 6th insurrection on Capitol Hill. The minority leader, Kevin McCarthy, denied some reporting that he had threatened to strip Cheney's other committee assignments because she agreed to serve on this committee. Let's listen.
What I'm saying is, it was shocking to me that if a person is a Republican, they get their committee assignments from the Republican conference. For somebody to accept committee assignments from Speaker Pelosi, that's unprecedented.
You know, I actually have to say that it was shocking in a way to see Liz Cheney standing there in the Capitol at a press conference earlier this week with some of the top-ranking Democrats talking about this committee. Aisha, your thoughts on this?
Well, what Liz Cheney said is that this is not about partisanship, but it cannot be forgotten that while you and I think McCarthy also said that maybe Liz Cheney has more in common with Nancy Pelosi than Republicans at this point. But it was Republicans who kicked Liz Cheney out of leadership. So there may be a bit of no love lost there. But there's no doubt that Liz Cheney is conservative. She doesn't have much in common with Nancy Pelosi policy-wise, but Cheney does believe that the attack, the insurrection on January 6th, should be investigated, and that it should be something where there that Congress comes together on to get to the bottom of, so that it doesn't happen again. It was a serious assault on democracy, and so at least on this point, she is with the Democrats on wanting to try to get to the bottom of it.
Only about a minute left, Olivia. I'm curious, might it have been better for Republicans to have gone along with a bipartisan independent commission to investigate the riot, which they previously rejected, Olivia?
Right. Well, it would have been a more limited investigation. It would have perhaps had a time limit. They would not have had subpoena power as they do now. I think that there is probably some regret going around. But just to Aisha's point, there's no doubt that Liz Cheney is a conservative. That's true. But I think that the question for a lot of Republicans, especially as they consider the events of January 6th, is not, are you a conservative? The definition of conservative has really become, are you going to support the previous president? And I think that's the question for Republicans going forward. Is conservatism about traditional, quote-unquote, conservative values, or is it about allegiance, loyalty, and fealty to the ex-president?
Olivia Nuzzi is New York Magazine Washington correspondent, also Aisha Roscoe, NPR White House correspondent. Thanks, as always, to both of you.
Thank you.
After waiting a year for courts to reopen at Wimbledon because of the pandemic, there is action again. On Monday, spectators were allowed to come back to the famous tennis venue. That's Serena Williams during her first round match against Alexandra Šaškovič. Serena Williams' bid for a 24th Grand Slam title came to an end when she injured her right leg early in the tournament. Other players such as Novak Djokovic and Coco Gauff made headlines with their skills on the court. Christopher Clary covers tennis for the New York Times. He's also the author of a new book. It's called The Master, a biography of Federer, and it comes out next month. He joins us from London, England. Welcome. Nice to have you.
Great to be with you, Jane.
So tell us what the atmosphere was like there this week at Wimbledon.
Well, as you said, it's been a year since they had the tournament, 2-year break. First time since World War II that's happened. You can sense the joy in the crowds that are here, but there are some big differences, and the most obvious one is that there's no queue, which is the famous line of fans who line up overnight, sometimes sleep in tents and try to get in and get tickets to the tournament. And then the crowds are half the size they normally are. But I have to say, the enthusiasm has been real, and it's been beautiful really to watch and hear the connection with the crowds again, because these players have missed that a lot over the last year.
Yeah. And so with the Delta variant surging now in the UK, are people wearing masks at Wimbledon?
Spectators are not required to wear masks when they're seated, but when they're circulating around the grounds, that's the requirement. Overall, it's been, a very good atmosphere in the first week, even though the weather has been pretty bad. Matches were played under the roofs, which has caused some issues with the grass. And but there's a lot of volume and enthusiasm at the All England Club again.
You mentioned the issues with the grass. Serena Williams is out of the tournament after suffering an injury to her right leg. Many players have slipped on the courts this year, players like British player Andy Murray. What's happening there, Christopher? Why are so many players hitting the ground at Wimbledon, and what are organizers saying about it?
Even Roger Federer slipped last night in his match, which is really rare for him on the grass with all the experience. Hey, I've been coming here almost for more than 30 years, Jane, and I've never seen so many slips in the earlier rounds of Wimbledon. A lot of it has to do with the fact that it has been really, really rainy in the lead-up. I have a feeling that as the tournament wears on and the weather improves and the courts wear in, you'll see less and less of that.
Well, and some other tennis superstars, Naomi Osaka, Rafael Nadal, they're among some of the players who are not at Wimbledon this year. Tell us what their absence means. Who are the top contenders still in the running?
Well, to be honest, both of those are big absences. Osaka is one of the biggest stars in women's tennis, behind Serena, probably the second biggest. And Nadal, of course, is a huge star and two-time Wimbledon champion, so that does leave a hole in the tournament for sure. But most of the other players are here, and I think there's a real excitement about the women's draw in particular, because there's a lot of uncertainty. And the men's title really is, can Novak Djokovic do what everybody expects Novak Djokovic to do, which is to win?
Right, because he's won the Australian and French Opens. So a Wimbledon win would be, what would that mean for him?
Well, he's also won the last two Wimbledons before the hiatus. So he's a great grass court player as well. He beat Roger Federer in that 2019 final, you might recall, where he had to save two match points, ended up winning in five sets. If he were to win Wimbledon, he would be in for a very, very special year if he can continue. Hmm.
So a few surprises this year, a few differences than in years past. What stands out to you, Christopher Clary, about what you're seeing this year?
Well, I think it's an interesting mix because you have emerging stars like Coco Gauff, had a great first Wimbledon when she came here at age 15 and reached the fourth round. And then, in contrast, you have nostalgia, which is you're seeing with Andy Murray and Roger Federer, who are both playing here and both still in contention in the tournament. So that really has been one of the big focuses. Murray hasn't played here since 2017. He's a Brit. He's playing with an artificial hip. Mm. So it's a remarkable comeback. And Federer is a huge crowd favorite at Wimbledon. He's won the title eight times. He's coming back from knee surgeries. And I think he's really come back in many ways just for this tournament, this occasion. And last night he played against Richard Gasquet, a French player, and won in straight sets. And I think he reminded many people of, you know, what it's like to watch prime Roger Federer, which was a bit of a surprise, frankly. Mm.
Well, before we let you go, are the traditional strawberries and cream available at Wimbledon this year? And have you had some?
Yes, they are. And I have had some. Yes, it's a tradition they've kept alive, and the price is quite reasonable.
Glad to see it's back. Christopher Clary covers tennis for The New York Times. He's also the author of a new book. It's called The Master, a biography of Federer, and it comes out next month. Thank you for speaking with me, and we hope to check in with you again next week.
Thanks so much, Jane.
You are listening to Megan Thee Stallion's new song, The Name of It I Will Not Say on the Radio. Most of her new music sparks a wave of new dance routines on the social media platform TikTok, but this one didn't. Black creators are refusing to share their choreography to the song because they say they're tired of white people using their moves without giving credit. Femi Okay is host of the stream on Al Jazeera English. Femi, take it from here, please.
All right, so we now have the answer, Peter, to what happened that one time when some of the best content creators on TikTok took a break from creating hit dances. No trending thought-ish dances from Megan Thee Stallion. What is going viral, though? TikTok posts with people attempting their own dance moves. Content creator Eric Lewis started his boycott by swaying and then walking off camera after giving a one-fingered salute. Eric was stunned to see two girls copy his strike video. It wasn't even a dance. They turned it into a TikTok dance. Have a listen.
Come on now. It wasn't even a dance. It wasn't even a dance. And y'all took that shit and ran with it. Got 900K views.
So clearly, some dance fans don't care about the boycott at all, but plenty are getting the message, like Randy here.
Megan drops a bop with instructions in the lyrics on how to do a dance, but because a black woman doesn't create one for us, that's the best we can come up with? We were invited to dinner and we brought underbaked, unseasoned baked potatoes. We brought potato salad with the raisins.
Okay. This is not the first time we've heard from frustrated black TikTok creators who aren't getting credit for their work. But obviously, this is about much more than just getting a mention on TikTok. Why do you think this is important?
Well, last June, TikTok directly addressed its black community. They promised to actively support people of color on the platform, make sure their content was protected and given the same treatment as white influencers. It all sounds pretty trivial, but there is a long history of culturally appropriating the work of black artists and then being rewarded for it, particularly in the United States. Regina Cage, who posts on TikTok, knows this history and supports the boycott.
I love this new generation. When they say, this ain't the Cotton Club, Bring It On, or the old Juke Joint, you're not going to keep running down into our neighborhoods, stealing our stuff and taking credit for it, and we do nothing. This is top shelf petty, and I'm here for all of it.
You know, the question that I have, Femi, is that when a video is shared sort of like a million times over, sometimes even more than that, how would a TikTok user who just sort of steps into the stream there, how would they even know how to properly credit somebody?
So, Peter, there's a pretty simple fix, and it's already part of the TikTok lexicon. DC means dance created by. You tag the creator. IB is inspired by, and then you tag the creator, whoever your muse happened to be. So this is TikTok etiquette that actually isn't being used, but it needs to be, because the minute everybody starts to say, this starts, DC was created by, or I be inspired by, then you can go and look for the original creator. It'd be right there. You click on them, you like the work, you follow the work, and then they get all of the kudos. So it's already in there. It's already in the platform. People are just not paying attention to it.
Well, they should. I'm wondering if TikTok has said anything about this, or even is Meg Thee Stallion said anything about this?
Mm-hmm. Well, I did look at Meg Thee Stallion's TikTok account, and she has shared one dance, because not all of the black TikTok strike dancers knew it was happening. It's sort of the word of mouth have gone along, or word of posts have been going along. And she shared the dance of Sky Beauty, who did some beautiful dance steps. So that dance is out there to her latest hit. And what has TikTok said? Well, they've issued a statement. It's pretty in line with the way that they've been talking about black communities on TikTok. And they said that they want to do is, and I'm going to quote them here, instill a culture where honoring and crediting creators for their creative contributions is the norm. That is end of quote there. And I'm just looking at how Megan Thee Stallion's hit is doing. Thought-ish, I'm going to call it. You know what it's called. You can go out and
that's the radio
look for it. Frida and I want to work next week, so we're not going to say it out loud. It's it's number 16 on the Billboard Hot 100. But a lot of black content creators are saying, aha, if we weren't on strike and we created our dances, it would be way up there on the Billboard Hot 100. So we're definitely seeing less dances. The dances aren't going viral, apart from some of the ones that are not quite up to scratch. I'm going to let you check them out for yourself. So look out for hashtag TikTok strike and hashtag a black TikTok strike, and you can see what happens when black content creators don't create dances. Peter.
The stats kind of prove their point, don't they? Femi Okeh, mm-hmm. host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English. Thank you.
You're welcome.
The first podcast series to ever win a Pulitzer Prize, NPR's No Compromise.
We dive into the political movement that's driving extreme gun rights activism and more. I'm Chris Haxel.
And I'm Lisa Hagen. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
The latest jobs report out this morning from the Labor Department is defying economists' expectations. In June, the U.S. added 850,000 jobs. As businesses continue a hiring surge to keep up with a rapid economic recovery. President Biden spoke about the jobs report this morning at the White House.
This is historic progress, pulling our economy out of the worst crisis in 100 years. Driven in part by our dramatic progress in vaccinating our nation and beating back the pandemic, as well as other elements of the American Rescue Plan.
For more now, we're joined by Mike Regan, senior editor for Bloomberg News. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Jane.
Well, break this down for us. Where did people find jobs in June, and what industries saw the biggest gains?
Well, the big standout was the leisure and hospitality category that saw a big gain of 343,000 jobs in June. And this is a group that includes bars and restaurants and all sorts of arts and entertainment and recreation employment. So it's not too surprising to see this bounce back as more restrictions are lifted. But still, it's good to see that recovery continuing strongly, Jane, because that is a really big employer in this country.
Mm. Well, despite these gains last month, both the unemployment rate and the number of people who are unemployed, 9.5 million, held pretty steady. So help us understand the discrepancy there.
So there's one really interesting phenomenon that's going on. And, you know, we tend to think of unemployed people as people who were laid off or fired. And that is the bulk of this group. But these days, this group also includes a lot of people who simply quit their job voluntarily. And there's a variety of reasons for that. Some were working at home during the pandemic, and now they're being asked to return, and they just don't want to. And for others, it has to do with not having the childcare to be able to return. And for some, it's just they sort of changed their priorities during the pandemic. So that number does include a lot of people who actually quit, as well as people who have been laid off.
Mm-hmm. Well, many employers, as you know, have been struggling to bring workers back as the economy reopens. Do these numbers reflect the easing of that hiring squeeze?
I think they really do signal that it's easing up a little bit, especially in that leisure and hospitality group I was talking about. That was one of the groups that was obviously at the center of job losses during the pandemic. And now as the reopening is going on, they're leading the gains as well.
Let me ask you about wages, Mike, because they went up about 0.3% in June. Put that into perspective. It doesn't sound like much.
Right. So that's the month over month rate. It's much higher on a year over year basis. But it's what economists call a really noisy number because it's jumped around all over the place during the pandemic and afterwards during the reopening because of the sort of the composition of jobs that were lost and then brought back. So I'm not sure it's quite normalized yet to give us a real sort of sense on what the trends are for wage growth. But one thing I'd point out is year over year, it's almost 4% in wage growth. But the cost of living measured by the CPI index was up 5% in May. So we need some better wage growth if the CPI index is going to continue to rise that much.
Well, Mike Regan, senior editor for Bloomberg News, thanks for putting it into perspective for us. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Jane.
Over 100 people have died in Washington State and Oregon as a result of the record heat wave that baked the Pacific Northwest earlier this week. Temperatures soared as high as 118 degrees. Virtually the entire western United States is suffering from extreme drought, and with these conditions, wildfires are intensifying. President Biden addressed the issue on Wednesday with a group of western governors.
We're remembering the horrific scenes from last year. Orange skies that looked like end of days, smoke and ash that made the air dangerous to breathe, more than 10 million acres burned, billions of dollars in economic damage, families that lost their homes and everything they own, and too many lost lives. And this year, there could be even tougher based on the weather patterns.
Oregon Governor Kate Brown, a Democrat, was at that meeting with the president. Governor Brown, welcome. It's good to speak with you.
Thank you so much for having me today.
So that meeting with the president happened in the same week that you declared a state of emergency in Oregon because of the threat of wildfire. What is the risk as you see it right now?
Well, just to give you a perspective about what happened last year, we saw more than 2,000 fires burning over a million acres. We unfortunately lost 9 lives and more than 4,000 homes. And since I've become governor, fire season has gotten worse every year. And this year alone, we've already seen 19 counties in drought emergencies. We are very, very pleased to see the administration taking a comprehensive, coordinated, strategic approach to address wildfires in the West.
Well, in that meeting with the president, your counterpart there in California, Gavin Newsom, said this after President Biden promised that the federal government would help.
Mr. President, I've been waiting almost 4.5 years to hear a president say what you just said. It's profoundly important, and I mean it. Look, it goes without saying, in California, we were engaged in a relationship with the federal government that was more like sparring partners, not working partners.
Can you relate in Oregon?
Oh, absolutely. I am just very excited that President Biden is absolutely committed to providing the Western states with both resources, financial resources, firefighting equipment like aircraft, and boots on the ground.
Governor, I want to ask you about the record-shattering heat that you experienced there in Oregon just a couple of days ago. It was crystal clear how big of a problem this is when that happened. How bad was it, and how far did it stretch your resources across the state?
Honestly, it was horrifying. We saw 3 days back-to-back of record-breaking temperatures over 115 degrees. This has never happened in the state of Oregon before. And just to give you a picture, it happened in the Willamette Valley. This is our garden area. This is where we grow our very valuable berries, our crops. It is really, really devastating. We worked closely with counties. Counties worked to meet local community needs by providing cooling centers, providing transportation for vulnerable community members to and from these centers, and of course, making sure that folks had adequate water available. obviously very, very impactful, unfortunately, for our unsheltered Oregonians and for our low income and communities of color. The disproportionate impact has been enormous.
Well, and right, we know that at least dozens of people have died. Health officials will tell you that heat deaths are preventable. We knew this was coming. Did you do enough to help make sure that people were safe?
Look, I was very, very saddened to hear of both the deaths of, for example, one of the migrant farm workers who passed away at work. This death is absolutely unacceptable. We are working with our state agencies to get more information. But as I said, this event was unprecedented in the state of Oregon, and it is a sign of changing climate. And we will be working to ensure that our communities have the tools they need. But this is going to require our federal administration to step up and do everything they can to tackle climate change. And I am hopeful that the Biden-Harris administration, along with Congress, understands the dire seriousness and will ensure that our local communities and the states have the tools and the resources they need to protect our citizens.
Drought conditions, many places across the West, are extraordinary. Can Oregonians expect water restrictions in the coming weeks and months and possibly years?
Well, I just got off a call from my Western governors. We have drought situations in just about every state in the West that I'm aware of, including the state of Hawaii. Obviously, in the West, we are used to dealing with drought, but the level we are seeing right now is, again, of historic proportions. And that's why it is so critical that the Biden-Harris administration work with Congress to pass the bipartisan infrastructure package. There are resources in that bill to help states like Oregon invest in both the natural and built water infrastructure. These are resources that states are struggling to find to pay for this level of infrastructure. And Congress taking action will be key to our being able to secure adequate resources for our future.
But do you expect that people in Oregon will have to cut back on their water use?
Look, I am asking Oregonians to be very aware of the challenging weather conditions that we are facing right now. I am encouraging Oregonians to use their water resources wisely. We know it's going to be extremely challenging for farmers and ranchers in our agricultural community. We also need to make sure that the folks doing the hard work of picking crops and working in the fields have water to drink and are working in adequate conditions.
Finally, Governor, before I let you go, on Wednesday, you ended most COVID-19 restrictions in the state of Oregon. As you know, the Delta variant is spreading fast in places all over this country, especially in areas with lower vaccination rates. How will you deal with that in Oregon without putting new restrictions in place?
That's a really good question. We are going to continue to double down in our vaccination efforts, and we're working fast and furiously to continue to get shots and arms. In terms of when we see outbreaks in communities around the state, we are moving to a more localized, traditional public health approach. But it is time for them to make decisions to protect their community members. And they have the expertise and now the experience to handle breakouts of the virus.
Right. But you know, despite your best efforts to get more vaccinations in people's arms, there is significant hesitancy, especially in more rural parts of the state. You've got that there in Oregon. Are you willing to put mandates back in place if these outbreaks don't get under control?
If we have no other options and if we do not have adequate hospital bed and healthcare capacity, yes. But I am confident that we have the tools with vaccines and our aggressive vaccination efforts to stop this virus in its tracks.
Oregon Governor Kate Brown, thank you so much.
Thank you. Have a great afternoon.
And we just heard the governor explain how record heat has been dangerous for farm workers in Oregon. Of course, it's also having a big impact just to the north in Washington. We're re-airing this report from the Northwest News Network's Anna King.
Central Washington farmer Alan Schreiber is worried about his
melon, watermelon, tomatoes, eggplant, okra. They need a lot of water.
Schreiber just found out his irrigation pump is only running at 30% capacity, and it's 117 degrees out.
We have stopped watering our perennial crops, so we're not watering our tree fruit, grapes, and berry crops.
He says those fruits can hold up with less water. Across the Northwest, agriculture is stressed. Blueberries are ripening so fast processors can't keep up. Potatoes, a valuable Northwest crop, are growing in weird shapes, making them hard to cut into French fries. Of course, most in peril are the humans. Some workers are picking cherries at night under floodlights. The region expects to continue seeing temperatures above 100 degrees into next week. For NPR News, I'm Anna King, outside of Eltopia, Washington.
Hesitancy among Black Americans to get the COVID-19 vaccine has commonly been associated with the untreated syphilis experiment, a study based in Tuskegee, Alabama, from 1932 to 1972. But experts say medical mistrust among Black Americans goes well beyond that. Connecticut Public Radio's Ali Oshinsky introduces us to one Black family that's working to rebuild trust in the medical system.
Sean Walters is 21 years old, and he wants to be a doctor someday. And when he does, his emphasis will be on making sure patients understand what's going on.
People are already set up to have mistrust, and you're going to have to figure out how to work around that and make sure that the information you're providing to them is actually getting to them.
His great-grandfather, Freddie Lee Tyson, was at the center of Exhibit A of medical mistrust. Tyson was subjected to the infamous United States Public Health Service syphilis study in Tuskegee. And I asked Walters, how much pressure does that legacy create for him as he starts his career in medicine?
Pressure? I feel like there would still be pressure to at least address some of the issues that are going on in medicine.
Tyson was one of the over 600 Black men enrolled, without his knowledge, in a study that's gotten a lot of press lately.
The men in the study were not injected with syphilis.
That's Lily Tyson Head, the daughter of Freddie Lee Tyson. She's also the president of Voices for Our Fathers Foundation, and she's been working overtime to dispel myths about the study. Correcting the record on that myth, she says, is especially important right now. Because while Black Americans are rolling up their sleeves to get the coronavirus vaccine, there's this idea out there that
that's why they hesitate, because they feel as though they will be injected with something, like the men were.
But the men weren't injected with it. And although 201 of the men weren't infected with the disease, 399 others already had it, including Tyson. He had congenital syphilis, meaning he was born with it. He was tested and denied care for 40 years. Doctors in the area were given a list with Tyson's and others' names and told not to give them penicillin. The original name was the Tuskegee Study of Untreated Syphilis in the Negro Male. But according to the CDC, it's now referred to as the United States Public Health Service Syphilis Study at Tuskegee. Dr. Wisdom Powell is the director of the Health Disparities Institute and a professor of psychiatry at UConn Health.
We are trying to solve medical mistrust as an individual level issue when, in fact, system structures and ecologic exposures are the catalyst for mistrust.
Those structures Dr. Powell describes have resulted in shorter life expectancies for Black Americans, according to the Connecticut Health Foundation. Also, Black babies are 4 times more likely to die before their first birthday than their white counterparts. And all in between, asthma, diabetes, and prostate cancer weigh more heavily and are more deadly among the Black population here. The Tyson family has plenty of reasons to mistrust the medical establishment. I spoke to 3 generations of them and heard something similar from all.
I'm very comfortable with the medical professional, but there's a lot of people that are not.
You know, bring somebody who's going to listen, because sometimes when doctors are telling you news, you're not really comprehending it.
Don't, like, hesitate to go to the doctor.
That was Wendy Tyson Wood, then Anthony Tyson, and Sean Walters. There's a combination of trust and skepticism in their views, self-advocacy, and awareness that the medical establishment has a lot of work to do. Again, Lily Tyson Head.
But it also comes with a lot of work on our parts as being diligent in finding the facts and making sure that we're getting the best healthcare possible.
Dr. Wisdom Powell of UConn agrees.
That speaks to just the capacity for resilience and the true investment in healing, growing, and thriving that exists within communities of color. That's a narrative that we often don't lift up, but that's so critically important.
Walters, the aspiring doctor who we heard from at the top, isn't sure if he'll enter biomedical research or pediatric sports medicine. Regardless, he'll join a very small group of Black doctors across the country, which make up only 5% of the physician workforce in the U.S., according to the Association of American Medical Colleges. Walters wants that to change, and he's already imagining a world with more Black doctors.
It would be ideal for someone to like see me in a doctor's office or see me in like a science lab and be like, wow, like I want to do that because he looks just like me or something like that.
Fixing that representation, he says, could change the healthcare field in many ways.
A lot of the issues that we're facing is because there's a lack of maybe representation, lack of the data, lack of people understanding that other people's voices are being diminished. And that's leading, obviously, to the issues that we're facing and the issues that we will face if things aren't being addressed.
And Walters has begun his journey to address them as an intern at Pfizer this summer. He's one of the many Tyson family members working to rebuild trust in the medical system and rebuilding that medical system to protect their health. For Here and Now, I'm Allie Oshinsky.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Jane Clayson in Boston.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd in Phoenix. This is Here and Now.